97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
I still can't believe I did that. That is, it's not a radio first, but it certainly is something I haven't done. For those people just joining, I walked out of the studio right around 3:46 or something like that.
Oof.
I thought it was 3:56. And it wasn't. Yeah. And then the show started again, and Ethan and Sue just took it away. It was a great segment, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm using that one as a best of.
Ethan said, Sue, we got to come back. And I said, what?
Sorry. I'm so sorry about that.
So we were talking about history of the Lou with Sue, because that's really all I've got. You know what I'm saying there, Fred?
I do. I will make sure, at least I'll try to make sure that that does not happen again.
Oh, my gosh. It was hysterical. I'm sure people were like, what is happening?
I thought maybe Mark got a call from Spire.
Yeah. Well, that's a reference to the earlier part of the show.
When you get them.
Yes. Well, the show started with Sue on hold with Spire. We thought it might take days, but they actually jumped on with you, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Okay, now where do I go with the show? I had a couple of things, but no, that's creepy. That's too creepy. I'm not going to do that one. There's new information on the... Fred, did you hear this? The son of the second Trump assassin?
No.
What?
Okay. It's creepy, but I'll do it as less creepy as I can. I had not heard about this guy. So the son of Ryan Routh, that's the dude that was arrested in connection with the assassination attempt, has now been taken into custody on federal charges of possessing child pornography. So what happened was is they wanted to look into this guy. The feds did, because they wanted to see if there was a connection. So they start going through his phones and stuff like that. They say this guy he's into so many different things. He's so weird. He's been in the media before, and now he's got a kid. Or maybe himself, who knows, that's dealing in child porn. They say that they discovered hundreds of files with child pornography during the search of his residence in North Carolina. And they say, look, that was in connection with an investigation unrelated to child exploitation, because it was an investigation related into the attempted assassination of a former president. And, you know, they say that according to the criminal complaint, this kid's name is Orrin Routh. In North Carolina, they searched his home. A review of an SD card in a Samsung phone found in his bedroom allegedly uncovered hundreds of files of child sexual abuse images. Files included videos from a known series. I don't know what that means. That includes videos of an adult man with a prepubescent girl under the age of 10. I mean, there, it's creepy. I'm not going to keep going here. But how bizarre is that, right? Mm. All right, something more positive. I got a couple of stories here that I don't, maybe you guys talked about this last week, so my apologies if you did. Did you talk about the cat that made its trek from Yellowstone to California?
No.
Okay, so we have stories like this every once in a while, and, you know, I think that the movie Homeward Bound sort of recounted a story that was not unlike this. So this is about the cat named Rainbow. And by the way, it's not spelled R-A-N-B-O-W, it's spelled R-A-Y-N-E. B-E-A-U, Rainbow.
Well, I'm annoyed.
I know, right? That's kind of the most annoying part of this story. So Susan Anguilano is the name of this person. They're on vacation in Yellowstone on June 4th. They don't even put this on Facebook. She's devastated. They lose this cat. Now, look, I have cats. I've had cats for a long time. Never really travel with my cat. If I go in a mobile trailer or something like that, an RV, and I have my cat goes missing, I'm going to kind of put that on myself, because I'm not sure that you should be doing that. But anyway, they love their cats. I love my cats. George Gray loves his cats. He would have reaction to this. So the cat gets out of the RV, and it runs off, and they can't get it to come back. And they're there for a few more days, and she's just devastated. She drives back to California with her husband. They don't talk because they're devastated. And then fast forward to just a couple of weeks ago, when there's another woman here. Let me see if I can get to this part of the story, because my computer just kind of made a different decision.
Wait, so it's weeks later?
It is. This is more than a month later.
Okay.
Okay, more than a month. June 4th. So this is into July at this point. Let's see here. I can tell you the exact date, because she says that, I don't know why I'm having so much trouble here, guys. Okay, July 31st. This woman named Alexander Betts is at her job at Sutter Roseville Medical Center in Roseville, California. It's hot that day, triple digits. And she says she hears, as she's going into the office or the hospital where she works, she hears some howling coming from bushes. And she thought it was a cat in heat or in labor. And she notices this small brownish cat near a storm drain. She hangs with it for a little while. And her fellow employees say, look, it's been here for a while. Maybe it belongs to someone nearby. So she checks in with her sister, who worked in an animal shelter, and The sister says, look, they howl like this if they're in distress, in heat, or lost. So they fed the cat, and then they scanned it for a microchip. It had a microchip, and it was back to its owner. Saturday afternoon, Susan gets the call just a few days later.
Oh my
she doesn't
gosh.
Even pick up the call. She sees it come in, and then she calls back because it was actually the animal shelter that called and said, hey, we have your cat.
Oh, that's amazing.
Now they're reunited. But how about that?
And how far would that be?
I don't want to misstate it here. I think it's 800 miles.
That Holy. Is nuts!
Yeah, 800 miles. Now, one of the questions, the obvious question that they had here is, did somebody help bring the cat
right.
back?
You wonder.
But they don't think so. And by the way, that person would have had to have gone in the right direction, right? They talk about in this story in the LA Times that there was a, we probably talked about it, in 2012, there was a Labrador named Bucky that walked 500 miles from Virginia to South Carolina to be eventually reunited. But that's crazy. 800 miles from Yellowstone to California. There you go. There's your feel-good story of the day after some creepy news here on 97.1 FM Talk.
These allegations are deeply concerning.
Does the president have any comment?
We're not going to comment.
It's not clear messaging.
No. And now, Sue's News. Brought to you by Sue.
Well, I feel like I should throw this in just because, you know, it's American and it's interesting. On this day in history, 235 years ago in 1789, the first Supreme Court was established, and it had six justices nominated by George Washington. And it wasn't until 1869 that Congress set the number of justices to the nine that we still have today. I did not know we started with six.
Yeah, me neither.
And then 56 years ago today, in 1968, Harry Reasoner and Mike Wallace hosted the debut of 60 Minutes.
Oh, look at that.
How about that?
That was back when they actually used to do real
Correct.
Stories and they weren't agenda-driven like they have been in the last decade.
Yep, and that's a shame.
It is
that
a shame.
Was a good show.
Because it was a good show, and I looked
yep.
forward to it. And
yes.
I talked about, you know, my deep love, and I miss him dearly, Tim Russert, Meet the Press, used to be destination television. 60 Minutes
yes.
used to be destination television. I saw some ads over the weekend, some promos for 60 Minutes. The stories looked rather intriguing. And then I thought to myself, I can't trust them for one damn minute
nope.
because they came in here making St. Louis look like a bunch of white supremacists because we were trying to get Kim Gardner to move out of the way so criminals would actually be prosecuted.
Exactly.
So 60 Minutes. R.I.P.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I say.
Well, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum from 60 Minutes, this show we do have sound for. This show came out 47 years ago. It premiered on ABC.
Exciting and...
Oh, I love this show.
Yeah,
you're
baby.
Like a 12 and 13-year-old kid, and you're watching Julie Twos and the rest of the cast of The Love Boat. That was a glorious thing back then, I just must tell you.
We weren't allowed to watch it. We had to go to the neighbors to watch it.
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because you had good parents, right?
Well,
Nothing
yeah.
against my parents listening right now, but they let
They're
me.
Great, but they let
they
you
let
watch.
Me watch The Love Boat.
We didn't have to sneak out.
The Love Boat, and then I guess Fantasy Island.
Well,
was right
yeah,
after
Fred.
It. Yeah.
Now, Ethan,
the plane right afterward.
You had to pull this audio from The Love Boat. Are you familiar with this at all?
Never heard of it.
Okay. Well, these were gems in the late 70s
yeah,
on ABC on a Saturday night, Ethan.
I got absolutely nothing.
Well, you know what? That's just as well.
Do you know Fantasy Island? They remade that into a movie.
Yes, because I think I've seen the movie. But
oh, did they do a series
yeah,
also?
Yeah.
I didn't know it was connected off an old show.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Most things are. There's nothing new.
Nothing new.
No, just assume.
You
but
guys,
that's great.
Yeah, this will not be surprising to you, this next story. Reggie Bush is suing USC, the NCAA, and Pac-12 over missed compensation for his name and likeness while he was playing football in college. Now, Reggie, of course, won the Heisman when he was running back for USC in 2005. One of his attorneys said, quote, "This case is not just about seeking justice for Reggie Bush. It's about setting a precedent for the fair treatment of all college athletes. Our goal is to rectify this injustice, pave the way for a system where athletes are rightfully recognized, compensated, and treated fairly for their contributions." That's what his attorney said. Well, I mean, he's just going to be one of a landslide.
So it's like sports reparations kind,
yeah, kind
of?
Sort of?
A bit. Yeah, that's interesting. I'd have to, Fred, we might want to follow on that. And
okay.
There's some good experts that we would have to talk about that. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, they say that USC, NCAA, Pac-12 continued to benefit financially, even when Reggie was out and playing in the NFL. I mean, they were
well,
using his
true.
Likeness, and I
right.
don't think that's wrong.
By the way, can I say one thing on the football related topic that I think Ethan will appreciate? Oh, maybe Fred too. Did you watch the Redskins? I'm sorry. Oh my gosh. I've just been canceled.
Year is it?
Holy smokes. My God, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so sorry about that.
I hear Steve Moore's footsteps now.
Did you watch the Commanders last night?
I did not.
Okay, let me just say this. And he's my backup. He's bound to be my starter, and I think he's going to be my keeper. Jaden Daniels, holy smokes, was that a great night for him?
It was unbelievable.
And an awesome game. This kid, you know, look, he went number 2 overall from LSU. He was the Heisman winner, and the Bears had a choice to make. They went with Caleb. He's probably going to be okay, but he's the Bears. But, man, Jaden looked amazing last night.
Yeah, I saw stories this morning saying he introduced himself to the NFL.
Well, and what's his name with Joe Buck last night? Troy Aikman. I can't believe I'm forgetting. Troy made a comment that was interesting to me. You know, in this era of the quarterbacks and everybody transferring in the transfer portal, he started 55 games in college. He was like a 5-year guy. Whoa. He started at Arizona State before he went to LSU. So 55 games on your resume gives him more experience than some of these other rookie quarterbacks, but he was super impressive last night.
Very that's good. Interesting. He's really good, yeah.
Actors get injured on the set all the time, and sometimes it looks so good you can't really tell that it's an accident. And BuzzFeed has come up with a list of those times. One of them was in The Princess Bride, which is why I bring it up now, because we all love The Princess Bride.
Oh, yeah.
Princess Bride! Have you seen that, Ethan?
I don't think I have.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Even my daughter's seen it, and
yes,
she loved it.
It is time for you to watch. It's very sweet.
Watch it with the wife.
Yes.
She would love it.
She'll love it.
It's a romantic movie. Right. It's really good.
Weekend activity.
It's got Andre the Giant in it. You can't beat it. Anyway.
And Billy Crystal.
And Billy Crystal.
Ethan Stills like
he wants you to have fun storming the castle. Anyone? Anyone? All right. The Princess Bride. There is a scene where Christopher Guest bonks Cary Elwes on the head with his sword. How do you pronounce it?
Elwes.
On the head with his sword, and they did it in one take, but he knocked out Cary for real. So when you see
that scene,
when he bonks him on the head, he knocked him out for reals.
That's fascinating.
It ended up being the most realistic take. So that's what you see in the movie.
Right.
There's a scene in Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, where Viggo Mortensen broke 2 toes by kicking a helmet. So when he screams and falls to his knees, that is not acting. No. He actually broke toes during that. So when you watch Princess Bride, watch for that particular
good to know.
Part
will do.
Because it's kind of crazy. And I have one good news story today. There's a runner from North Carolina named Tara Dower who just broke a world record by hiking the entire Appalachian Trail in 40 days, 18 hours, 5 minutes. That's just under 2,200 miles. She did an average of 54 miles a day. And a guy from Belgium held the record, and she beat him by more than 13 hours. She raised a bunch of money for charity and gave it to Girls on the Run. Oh.
So just do the math on the did you say 54 miles?
How do you do that?
How do you do that? You're not just walking,
you
right?
You've got to be doing some running.
Right.
Yeah. She must be a serious runner/athlete. And finally, in Sue's News, we have today's random fact. Okay, I did not know this. The Oval Office has pressure sensors in the floor so that the Secret Service can monitor exactly where the president is when they're not allowed inside. Isn't that fascinating?
That's crazy.
Wow.
So if something does happen, they know exactly where to go?
Correct.
I've never heard that one.
I don't know about you guys, but I feel like I am constantly underestimating the amount of technology that our government and just that there is in the world that we just don't think about. And honestly, I don't know if I want to think about it because it probably would scare me to know how much.
Because they have computer chips in all our brains right now and they're controlling us? What's wrong with
maybe.
That?
Who knows?
Yeah. No, you know, look, I think to your point, you know, this stuff that they're investigating with this second assassin, I can't even imagine the pinging, all this technology that they have to track people when they go all in on these investigations. I think we'd all be rather shocked.
All of this, yet they couldn't figure out who had cocaine in the White House.
I know, isn't that weird? We couldn't figure that out, and we can't make
still
a phone call if
head.
We're passing by the St. Louis Zoo, but we can put a rover on Mars and all that technology, too.
That's it for Sue's News.
Thank you, Sue. Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you, Ethan. Fred, the Hall of Famer, in here as well. I felt like listening to a little Prince with his guitar this afternoon. We're coming back with more in a moment. You know who I have not had the privilege of speaking to in a while? That's the governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, and he's going to join us this afternoon in the 5 o'clock hour. This is the execution night for Marcellus Williams to finally leave the planet, and hopefully this will all take place. I don't think the United States Supreme Court will get involved. But we'll explain that case and talk about really Lisha Gale, who was the subject of a brutal murder. And I don't really like to mention Marcellus's name because she was the victim. We're going to focus on her a little bit here after 5 o'clock. Kat Rosenfield is with me right now. She writes at the Free Press. And if you're not subscribing to the Free Press, you don't know what you're missing right now. But wrote a piece that I saw last week that kind of fascinated me. So we invited Kat to join us this afternoon. Kat Rosenfield, how are you? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk in St. Louis.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So the name of the piece was "To the Woman Who Trashed Me on Twitter," and you tell this fascinating story of a woman that you call Jane, not her real name. But you got to go back in history just a little bit to back in 2016 when Trump was first running for president, don't you?
Yeah, Jane was a colleague of mine, and around the time that Trump became the nominee for president, as I'm sure you know, a lot of people who worked in media, where I'm situated, kind of lost their minds a little bit,
and they continue to.
Yeah, just a tad. It got very censorious. It got very kind of fraught to be on the side of free speech, which I always have been, a free speech liberal. And those of us who were still willing to talk about being in support of free speech were sort of excoriated in public, but in private we became these sort of like secret confessors in our Twitter DMs and inboxes, became like a little confessional for people who weren't actually very happy with what was happening, but didn't want to say so on main, didn't want to say so out loud because they didn't want to be canceled. And Jane was one of these people who used to message me and say that she was concerned about the climate, that she was concerned about her career, that she didn't like what was happening. And that went on for about 2 years. And then it stopped when she decided instead to kind of publicly attack me for being problematic.
So you even had, again, not a real name, but you talked about her. She was a colleague and you guys had freelance gigs at the same time. And she wrote, "I'm trying to tell myself every day that this censorship, hypersensitivity, et cetera, is the natural exuberance of a new movement still feeling out its own limitations. I spend so much time every day now wondering if my peers actually want to suspend the First Amendment or are just angry, emotional posturing." So that happens. And then 5 years later, explain, you write an article about COVID, right? And then you hear a little bit from Jane again.
Yeah, I had written about the campaign to push Joe Rogan off Spotify, which I thought was potentially problematic in terms of what it implied for free expression, the First Amendment, free speech. And then I discovered that Jane had taken exception to it and was just sort of publicly trashing me on Twitter with another podcaster who I also will not name. And, you know, the thing about this experience, it was obviously it's very unpleasant to discover that you're being stabbed in the back by somebody you considered a friend. But the thing about this that I think is more important than what I personally went through is that a lot of people have had a similar experience to this, because we do live in a moment and did then and do now where people are very opportunistic and very tribal and willing to sacrifice trust and connection in order to participate in this very binary thinking.
It's amazing. So, but why, Kat, why not just say, "Hey, Jane, F you, I'm going to release your DMs," and this is what you were saying. Why even try to protect her at this point? I'm curious.
I just want no part of that paradigm. I think it is incredibly toxic and incredibly ugly, and I'm trying to be the change that I want to see in the world. So, yeah, I won't be naming her.
I can appreciate that and I understand that. But you also related this, and I don't know if it's just because she's got the same name as you, but you related this to something that you read in Kat Timpf's new book, right? Explain that.
Yeah, that's right. Timpf, who I've actually been on TV with a couple of times. I think people enjoy the novelty of us having the same first name. she has written a new book. Everyone should check it out. It's really wonderful, very funny, very vulnerably and well-written. It's called "I Used to Like You Until." And she talks in it about this trap of binary thinking that leads people to disassociate from their friends, their confidants, over politics. And what she's identifying there is the same phenomenon that I have written about at the Free Press before, which I call fandom politics. She calls it binary thinking. But the point is that it's very tribal, and it is something that has been ascendant, I think, for the last 10 years or so, but it's gotten especially potent gets especially put into around elections and around this one in particular.
Yeah, and I don't know how we get out of that. In you know, I was thinking about this even this week with a friend of mine. I have a pretty, used to be a good friend that worked for, still works for CBS News. We go way back to journalism school at the University of Missouri, been friends for decades. And he didn't like what I was saying on the X, formerly Twitter, a few years ago. And essentially, I mean, we were relatively close, and then that was it. It was like done. There was no conversation or anything like that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of that going on right now. It's probably going to go on again this Thanksgiving at people's homes.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that it's probably true. You were saying, I don't know how we get out of it. I don't know how we get out of it either, except by individually choosing not to participate in it. And so I still maintain friendships with people who I disagree with politically and will continue to do so. Well, and hopefully leading by example will work.
Yeah, and I think, look, and I've said this before as someone who is more libertarian conservative. Most of my friends are not libertarian conservative. They're more liberal. And, you know, I kind of deal with that. But I'm curious about your thoughts on how the media is handling a lot of these situations right now. I played a soundbite from Hillary Clinton yesterday where she's defending Kamala Harris not doing interviews because apparently it's somehow sexist to demand that a female presidential candidate actually talks to the media. But there's a lot of stuff going on. One of the reasons I love the Free Press, because I think Barry's done a great job over there with real journalism, Kat, and I don't see that a lot in the rest of the so-called capital J journalism world out there.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with you on that. I mean, I, of course, very partial to the Free Press. I work there. I think we're wonderful. I think that there are a number of good journalists working in mainstream news organizations who are still doing a good job, who are unbiased, who are objective, and who are doing their best to remain open and to get the truth out there. But when you mentioned Hillary Clinton, I think it is very interesting, actually, that you can trace the rise of a lot of the sort of tribalism. Again, this is something that Tim talks about in her book, back to her basket of deplorables comment that she made on the campaign trail in 2016. And a very interesting thing that happened then was that people on the other side allowed themselves to be defined by that comment. They were like, you called me deplorable? Yeah, I'm going to be hella extra deplorable. I'm going to be so deplorable it makes your hair stand on end. And that kind of reactive, almost oppositional, defiant behavior where you allow somebody who treats you with contempt and with loathing to sort of define who you are and who you choose to be is something that Tim talks about in her book and I think is part of what makes this so toxic. So everybody basically has to opt out or it's just going to keep getting worse.
I love, by the way, you use a quote from Kat Timpson in her book and she says, it's pathetic, but it's true. Politics makes us fight with the people we actually know on behalf of people who don't even know we exist. That says a lot right there, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a terrible thing about this binary trap is that it has us at each other's throats. So much of the culture war stuff that we fight about with our friends, with our family, all of that is a distraction from what is actually happening. And it is to the benefit of people who actually have power, who could be making the world a better place and who are let off the hook for doing that because they would prefer us to be fighting with each other rather than looking at what they're up to.
You're probably right about that. Kat Rosenfield, thank you so much for jumping on here with me in St. Louis this afternoon. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, take care. You know, and we would definitely disagree on the media and the way that the media is handling all of this, because I don't even think that that's in question right now when it comes to fairness. And I do love the Free Press because Barry, and by the way, Barry Weiss is no conservative. She left the New York Times not because it was too liberal, but because they weren't interested in truly acknowledging all sides of issues.
Wow.
And this came, you know, with the Tom Cotton op-ed that they wanted to spike. And that's the circumstances of how she left. But overall, Kat's point is also, I think, a little broader on that spot, because we all get backed into our corners. But I think that the corners would not be as extreme if the media landscape was more fair.
Agreed.
Because one of the reasons that we're so tribal is you got the conservative, you know, punditry world, Fox News, used to be Rush Limbaugh, shows like mine, right? And then you have everything else on the other side.
Yep.
And there is no effort to, well, we used 60 Minutes as an example earlier, right? And it's sad because we used to be able to think that 60 Minutes really stood for something that they were going to go. Mike Wallace is a great example. When Mike Wallace was one of the correspondents on 60 Minutes, he would give everyone hell, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't matter who was sitting next to him. He was going to ask tough questions of that person. Consequences be damned, right? But we don't see that anymore. I don't see the intensity being in an equitable way dispersed across. Of course it's not, right? So I think that the media and the way that they've become tribal, because they're cheerleaders, they're forcing agendas, they're not interested in telling both sides of the story. Look, Joe Biden today mentioned climate in his speech to the UN 6 times. He only mentioned Iran twice. You know, in a fair media world, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post would do a story about that saying, wait, maybe we're a little off on our priorities here, but they won't do that because they believe the climate science nonsense and the junk. And they want to stuff that down people's faces and, you know, down their throats. And that makes everything worse because you got the NPR audience believing one thing. You got the rest of the people believing another thing, which is usually the truth. And there's nowhere in the middle that people can meet, sadly. We're coming back with more in a moment. Hang in there. All right, Sue, you know, we have talked quite a bit about downtown St. Louis and businesses that are not very comfortable because of crime issues, et cetera. We know that the AT&T building sold for, what, a couple of bucks. It was like $2 or $3 or something like that. I mean, in the whole scheme of things, it really was because it was $3 million when it was $300 million. The person who bought that building, I think, plans some it's apartments, huge. Luxury. It is huge in retail.
Good.
So there are some people that I think are believing in downtown, including Alex Oliver, who's with us. He's with Oliver Properties, and he's developing some apartments on Washington Avenue. Alex, how are you this afternoon? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk.
Hi there. I'm doing good.
Well, the question for you would be, why, when everyone's down on downtown St. Louis with crime and other issues, are you thinking this is a good idea to develop in downtown St. Louis on Wash Avenue?
Yeah, I mean, I've been very encouraged. We've been we acquired our property on Wash Ave about 9 months ago, and we've had an incredible success down here. So we've been
good
upgrading existing apartments. So that's really kind of our bread and butter. We're taking on, you know, these are historic buildings that were converted to apartments about 20 years ago, and they've been under amenitized and maybe kind of mismanaged and not reinvested in the last few years. So we're taking on existing buildings, adding amenities, better, stronger management, and really focusing on neighborhoods that are quite honestly quite walkable with restaurants and shops and bars and amenities right out the people's front door. And we've had incredible success.
Love
it. But some of those, I mean, look, if we're looking at Wash Avenue in particular, and that's only a few blocks from where we're sitting right now, there are a lot of good things that are going on down there. And I see a lot of activity on weekends. But we've also seen videos of some of the apartment buildings that are nearby in the middle of the night with shots being fired and people running and scurrying into alleyways. So there's no doubt that there are issues related to crime and safety in those neighborhoods as well. So how do you confront, what's the relationship you have, for example, with local leaders, if we have any, or law enforcement?
Well, you know, we try to work as much as we can with, you know, the city and GSL and the police. And there's also, you know, the downtown SID. We're a supporter of the new downtown North SID, which I think is going to add some additional, you know, eyes and ears and security on the streets. But we also really focus on, you know, are our buildings secure? Are we doing good screening for our residents? Are we making sure we're getting the right people in the building, keeping the wrong people out of the building? And the more people that live down here and the more people that are out on the street, that's more eyeballs and ears and cars and people that discourage people that do want to cause problems from being in the area.
I'm amazed by, now look, I own a home and I haven't rented it in a long time, but when I drive around, and Sue, even when you go down 44, you look at what's happening, you know, near SLU, there's so many apartments that are going up. There's desperate need, I guess, for more housing, including apartments in the area. So I'm guessing that your demand is very high right now.
Yeah, demand's been really strong. So, you know, over the winter and in the spring, we were doing a lot of renovations at the building. So we hadn't really started active leasing yet until we got into more like in the May area. And in the last 90 days, we actually have a couple buildings there on Wash Ave. We've signed over 90 leases in the last 90 days, which is an incredible leasing pace.
Well, what is your thought or vision for, because I mentioned the guy, I can't remember who bought the AT&T building, but I was told that part of his vision is for more retail downtown, which, let's face it, we don't have a lot of that right now because it doesn't seem like there's enough demand for that. Do you think there should be more retail? I mean, there's not even grocery stores that are, you know, within. I guess Schnucks is within walking distance of Wash Avenue, but Fields Foods closed down, so we still have, you know, there's challenges. Gas stations are tough to find downtown, et cetera.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a mixed neighborhood. You know, that's one thing that has drawn us down here, and I think it draws our residents who want to live down here, is that mix of there's residential, there's retail, there's shops, there's office. And yes, that does make for a stronger residential neighborhood or really a working business neighborhood when there is more service-providing retailers. But it's a supply-demand, you know, balancing act. Like you said, is there enough demand down here to sustain those retailers who are here? And that's why we're really focusing on what is our bread and butter is multifamily housing. Are we driving more residents down here that have disposable incomes, that are going out to eat, that are frequenting these retailers to make it so they can be successful and continue to grow? And we're having some success on that front as well. We have ground floor retail spaces in several of our buildings, and we've got a couple leases coming and some LOIs we're negotiating. So the people who want to be down here because they see the traffic.
Hey, Alex, it's Sue. I think one of the cool things about doing stuff like this is that we've got all these really sweet old buildings with all this character, and that's got to be part of the draw.
Oh, yeah. So I've been investing in real estate, multifamily buildings in St. Louis for 17 years. I'm a transplant, moved here in 2007, started buying, you know, fourplex and duplexes in South City, and really fell in love with the historic character. And I think that is a unique nature that at least the properties we're focusing on along Wash Ave, they do have this historic character. You mentioned the new construction near SLU and in St. Louis County and in St. Charles, and there's a place for that. I think there's some real character and you know, the large floor plans, the tall ceilings, the amazing character in the buildings is very unique to our downtown infrastructure, and I think that's got a real appeal.
How do you use some of that character in the apartments? I mean, the best example, I think, from that area is what City Museum represents, right? Because you still have the infrastructure from
the International Shoe Company.
Right, exactly. So are there things like that in some of the apartments?
Yeah, so our 6-core building, that's right at between 10th and 11th on Washington. So we're at 1000 Washington right there. It has these large brick archways all throughout the first floor. You know, 14 to 16 foot ceilings. Several of our units are actually 2-story units.
Wow.
The ceilings were so tall that they're basically like townhouses inside the units. So we've taken advantage of the ceiling heights. We've got exposed wood, you know, beams on the ceiling. You see the brick archways. It makes for these really tall windows on all the window lines. So it really takes advantage of that big open footprint that these old buildings had.
Awesome. Well, Alex, thanks for jumping on here with me. You can go ahead and give your website out if you want people to kind of check that out.
Yeah, so all of our properties, so OPSTL, all of our properties, STL, is our company website. And then our downtown building that we're doing most of our leasing at is 6Cord, S-I-X-C-O-R-D. So 6Cord Downtown Apartments.
Alex Oliver, thank you so much. Good luck with everything. Keep us posted.
All right, I appreciate it.
We got one more hour to go here on 97.1 FM Talk. And I mentioned this a little earlier, have not chatted with Governor Parson. Haven't really asked him if he's got another Kansas City Chiefs tattoo, for example. we have not visited with the governor in a while. But look, it is a serious issue. We're going to talk about Marcellus Williams and the execution that's set for 6 o'clock tonight. We'll talk a little bit about the border. And he went to Panama recently as well. Then there's a story that has kind of developed in the Springfield area related to some gender stuff, which is always interesting. We'll get to that. Plus, an audio cut of the day and more coming up.
Get more at 971talk.com.